Welcome to Impacting the Classroom, the podcast where you can listen to dynamic interactions among educators, policymakers, and researchers who are making an impact in the classroom. I'm Dr. Darlene Estes Del Rey.
And I'm Arnetta Larimer. Today, we're jumping into an important topic. I've really been looking forward to having this discussion: how to build a more inclusive and equitable education system. And I am beyond excited to introduce one of my favorite people who I know will have a lot of things and thoughts to contribute to this subject, Dr. Rosemarie Allen. Dr. Rosemarie Allen is the president and CEO of the Center for Equity and Excellence. She has served as an educational leader for over 30 years. Her life's work is centered on ensuring all children have access to high quality early childhood programs that are developmentally and culturally appropriate. She is currently an associate professor in the School of Education at Metropolitan State University of Denver, where her classes are focused on ensuring teachers are aware of how issues of equity, privilege, and power impact teaching practices. Dr. Allen also serves as the president and CEO for the Institute for Racial Equity and Excellence, IREE, if you want to look that up, which is the lead agency for ensuring equity in educational practices throughout the nation.
Welcome, Dr. Allen. I'm with Marnetta, super thrilled for this conversation. And I know all of our podcast listeners are going to be equally excited and thrilled to know that this is just going to be a really organic conversation about this topic today. And so we're going to leave being enriched by this conversation and inspired. So I get the pleasure of kicking us off with the first question. So we've been hearing a lot more about diversity, equity, and inclusion over the last year or so since George Floyd's murder. And there was an initial flurry of work that bustled up from that to create a more equitable system. And it seems like schools and education companies have continued the work. But I'm curious, Dr. Allen, if you think the needle has moved, and whether children, particularly children of color, have seen direct improvements from this recent push and emphasis on equity.
Well, first, I want to say thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It is an honor and a pleasure to be here, especially to have these conversations that's avoided by so many. Mm-hmm. Yes, the murder of George Floyd revealed systemic racism that has been long-term and ongoing, actually since the inception of the country. And once it was revealed, people seemed to be surprised and overwhelmed by the vehemence of the people of color, specifically Black people, and the fight for equity and the fight for justice. And once people saw it, someone asked me once, what was the difference? Because we've had murders before. We've had murders happen. I mean, and I can just give you a list of names, but the murder of George Floyd hit differently. And people ask why. And this is a Rosemarieism. Mm-hmm. I believe that we were already in this triple pandemic, that people were at home. And you remember, it wasn't like it is now. During this time, we could not leave the house except for essential. So people were quarantined, mandated to be at home. And many people were struggling. So that was one pandemic. And then the whole economic pandemic, where people could not work and losing their jobs. And then the racial pandemic. So people were at home. So when this recording of the murder of Mr. Floyd happened, they couldn't look away. Mm-hmm. It was one of the first times that you were stuck. You didn't have a lot of distractions. You couldn't say, oh, I don't want to look at this, because it was everywhere. And I believe it's one of the first times that we saw the actual murder, because so many died later. But we actually mm-hmm. saw the knee on his neck until he took his last breath. And I believe every mother in the world had a collective reaction when, as he was dying, he called for his mama. who had died just 6 weeks earlier. And I believe that's what hit us differently. And it really resulted in a call to action that was worldwide. Now, since this happened, there changes have taken place across the globe. People now understand better, some people, that there are inequities in our society, and Black children on every single indicator of well-being are at the very bottom, at the very, very bottom. And people have begun to realize this. And we're seeing organizations, institutions, agencies, especially educational agencies, wanting to make a difference. Before the murder of George Floyd, lots of my work was one-and-done workshops, hit-and-miss workshops, keynote workshops. I have to say, over the last year, that has changed tremendously. People are saying, we want to dig deeper. We really, really want systemic change. They want to understand the difference between individual racism, institutional racism, systemic racism, and to make changes at the systemic level. And because of that, Darlene, we are not seeing the needle move yet for children because this is a process. And that process begins first with the individual to say, I am a biased, racist, flawed individual. And the impacts that I have on children can be negative. And then to say, and I work for a biased, racist, flawed institution. And we have to do something about that. And then to say, the institution that I work in is part of a web of institutions that are biased and racist and flawed, from social services to healthcare to law enforcement to our judicial system. My system interacts with those and are intrinsically tied to those, and I have to do something at that point. So we can't measure it yet. Because if we do, whatever results we see will be false because it takes a while to really impact systems. But what I can tell you is that I've seen a change in behaviors of people, understandings of people. We're seeing more positive impacts directly with children and families and how they're viewed and how they're interacted with. So we're seeing changes there, but we do have quite a way to go for institutional systemic change.
I deeply appreciate that. And I think too, like just in my own journey in this path, you know, like when I hear systemic racism, I thought about systems. I always have, but I didn't really think about it like in the way that you describe that we sometimes don't just envision all the ones that interconnect, like you said, how they all come into interplay and just then the collective impact that has as well. So I just appreciate you pointing that out and helping us to realize there's a lot to unpack. There's much to do. And then if we do it really well, we're going to see those impacts coming to the children who most certainly deserve it. And then it'll be a lifetime change for them too. So I certainly appreciate you setting the stage for this conversation. And I'm going to kick it to Marnetta for the next question.
Yeah, I think in hearing, you know, just what you said, you're right. There's such a, you know, as a, you know, woman, a Black woman with two Black boys, right? My heart was like, it broke, you know, and I think the awareness that came around George Floyd's murder was very eye-opening, right? I live in a neighborhood I've lived in for like 20 years that my children can't go out and jog in, even though we've lived here for like 20 years. And it's like you said, there's things that are changing, right? I have neighbors who might speak now or whatever, but it's been slow. It's still progress, but it's very slow moving. But like I said, it's been like 20 years. It's been like I've lived here. How long do I have to live here as a great citizen, right? Before I'm acknowledged as a being worthy of, you know, engaging in just regular things, right? Like jogging around the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. My question for you would be, you know, as we think about these systems and how they're integrated and, you know, the biases and challenges and barriers for people of color, what would be the first steps, you know, that you would recommend for an organization or a program to design and implement equity-focused programs? And that could just be in general or around the, you know, American Rescue Plan Act funding that's coming down, but what would you recommend to start that base?
Absolutely. You know, the first is to conduct a temperature check. Who are we? Who do we say we are? And who are we really? Because right after the murder and the civil unrest, people began to create amazing, beautifully worded equity statements and mission statements. So that's great. That's a start because it's saying this is who we want to be. But are you really? How are you living out your mission, vision, and value statement? So the first step would be to engage in an equity audit. Let's take an audit of your practices, policies, rules, and see where barriers are that prevent people of color. I'm not going to just say children, because in order for children to do well, the workforce must do well. So let's just take a look at who we are. So what's included in an equity audit? First, an equity audit might say we value racial equity and we will put procedures in place that will elevate this, and we value a diverse workforce. And let's look at the workforce. So if that's who you say you are, let's look at your workforce and see, based on positions, where people of color are and are not. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I believe it's 70% of the early childhood teacher workforce are women of color.
Yes, ma'am.
They are women of color, and there are unconscionable wage disparities, especially between Black and Hispanic workers and white workers in same positions, being paid about $1.12 an hour less for Black women in the same position. And for Hispanic and Latinas, they are relegated to the lowest level positions as assistant, as teacher's aides, usually in the infant room. And Black women as well, it's reminiscent of antebellum South when they were wet nurses and had to take care of babies. And when we think about history and what has happened, and very little room for growth. So you see Black and brown women in those direct care positions, but the higher up you go, the fewer you see. And in many situations, the leadership is all white. So if you value diversity, and then you take a good look at your workforce, what does that tell you? If you value diversity and you work in an affluent area and a small percentage of your children are of color, what does that tell you? If you value diversity, but your parent organizations and support systems are predominantly white, what does that tell you? And also, when you conduct an equity audit and you talk to your workforce of color, your people of color, and they say they can't be their authentic selves, that they're forced to code switch when they come in. And code switch means to change who they are to assimilate and be accepted in that work environment, or say that they have very little room for growth. That equity audit will give you so much information. So that's the starting point, Marnetta. And then next, you take the data and create a comprehensive plan on how you're going to impact change. And that is the hard part. Mm-hmm. Because, for instance, let's take the workforce. I was working with an agency in Chicago, and the principal of the school had such a heart for equity, just amazing. He said, "Rosemarie, I don't understand why all my paras are people of color and all my teachers are white. I just don't understand that." And I said, what do you think is happening? He said, "It's very hard for me to find people of color who are qualified." Let me tell you, that is the biggest myth in America. Yep. The biggest myth.
You saw my face.
The biggest myth. There are highly qualified people of color in every sector of the system. You have to know how to recruit them and then how to retain and support them. So anyway, he said, I just can't find any. I said, okay, well, let's take a look. Why don't we first do an audit of your files, qualifications? We went through every staff member's file, looked at all their qualifications. 60% of his paras had master's degrees. Wow. 60. He said, I never knew. I didn't know. And I said, so here are your qualified people. So the question is, why didn't you see it? And this isn't to blame or shame. You all know me. I don't believe in blaming or shaming, but there comes a time when you have to look inward and be very honest about what you see, because this is what happens across the country. You have people who go to school, they take out student loans, they're trying to elevate and engage in this upward mobility, but they're never seen. They're never seen as anything except a para or except an aide. So when these positions come in and they interview within their own agencies, the bias of the agency keeps them in the box where they believe they belong.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, start with the equity audit, then address some of the deficiencies, but also engage in long-term systemic training that's going to, as you asked earlier, Darlene, move the needle. And at the end of that year or two, after the training and implementing policies and looking at your practices, then conduct the exact same audit. I say 18 months to 2 years to see where that needle has moved.
That was a powerful response. And I had the feels again, right? Because, you know, you're talking, it's like you're saying my life, right? Like what my journey has been, because it's very challenging. And people get very comfortable because that's what they're used to seeing. And, you know, the women of color, they're happy to have a job, right? You've got to feed your family. We're doing what we need to do, but then you start believing this is all it is, right? Because that's becomes the norm for you. And so then we get into that, you know, internalized, right? Oppression, right? And that's a whole nother cycle. Oh, that's a whole nother conversation, right? That we could go into.
It's really amazing because it happened to me. I directed our lab school. I was at a community college and I really wanted to move up in higher ed. And I continued to apply for dean, position of dean, but they could not see me as anything other than the lady who takes care of the babies across campus. And it was so bad because I turned inward as well. And I said, well, maybe it's because my degree is early childhood. Let me go and get a master's in education. So then I invested in that just to show them I could do more. And in order for me to move up, I actually had to leave that college.
Yeah, that's how I got here. That's a whole nother story. That's how I ended up at Teachstone. Just because, you know, you have to recognize when there's no growth, right? So, you know, us as a people, we have to recognize where we're not being seen, not being represented, and that needle isn't moving, and just know that there are places you can go that are feeding into this work and really recognize, right, and are leading with intention to put you in those spaces that you didn't think that you could get into before.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, and that's on an individual basis. If you don't mind, I want to go back to the use of some of the American Recovery Plan dollars.
Yes.
When you ask, and when I talked about the equity audit, and you talked, and we just talked briefly about mobility and what that looks like, and what it's going to take for us to really impact change using those recovery dollars is to look at things differently and with a new lens. I just have to say there are states who have already unveiled their plans, and it broke my heart that so many never, ever mentioned racial equity, not in the plan at all. And when you look at this administration's goal, President Biden has been very clear about racial equity, and these funds can really, really make a change. For instance, here in Colorado, they put the funding in three buckets: access, workforce, and family strengthening. you can't talk about access without talking about the inequities in access.
Right.
So I'm going to take you back a little bit.
Okay.
Every agency has relied on three studies that took place in the 60s to talk about the cost benefit of early childhood education: the Perry Preschool Project, Abecedarian, and Chicago Child Study.
Okay.
Those three studies were conducted on primarily an all-Black population. Perry Preschool Project, 100% of the participants were Black families. Chicago Child Study, I believe, is 97%. Abecedarian, 93% were Black. We have to look at the racial backdrop of those studies. Those studies were not conducted to improve the quality of early childhood education. Those studies were conducted to fix the inherent deficits of Black children, because they were believed to be inherently deficit.
Mm-hmm.
Think back, 1960s. These children, we have to teach them how to be citizens of our country. And their IQs are inherently low. So especially Perry Preschool Project was to increase IQ scores. They thought that parents were not equipped to raise their children, that they were pretty much inept. Just take a look at it. And David Weikart is real clear about why they put this study in place. So the study was conducted from this pathological lens and the way that Black children and Black families were viewed. We had amazing outcomes from that. We know that there were long-term benefits in terms of increased achievement over time, decreased teen pregnancy. Remember, that was another one of these people, get pregnant. decreased pregnancy rates, income, long-term jobs, all of the benefits. But imagine how much farther we would have been had they seen the children and families from a strength-based lens.
Right.
And actually talked to the families about their goals for their children. Talk to the teachers. Louise Derman Sparks, you know, she was a teacher in that Imperial Preschool program. And she talks about how they never talked to them about how well the children were doing. They didn't get the teacher perspective. So why do I go back to that? It's because we can learn from that if we want to do better. So those same children who gave us the data on the importance of high quality early childhood education are the same children today who cannot access high quality early childhood programs. The same children.
Right. And how long has that been? Right. So when we talk about a needle, right, we're not talking like it's a walk and, you know, it's not a walk, it's a run. Like, we're talking like snail pace, like slow inches, because that was a long time ago.
Yes.
Right. It's the same challenge.
So they cannot access high quality programs. And when they do, they're pushed out through suspensions and expulsions.
Yep.
There's something wrong with using the data of people that have been proven to work and not allowing access. So when we look at access, we have to look at how few children of color, specifically Black children, have access to high quality early childhood programs. So that's one. And then the workforce, we talked about a little bit, and I've seen states come up with amazing things. I mean, free education to help teachers become qualified. That is amazing. But we can't ever apply colorblind policies.
Mm-mm.
Because what will happen is those who stand to benefit the most will be left out. So what are we going to do to make sure our Indigenous, Hispanic, Latino, African-American populations not only access the funds, but are in cohorts to support each other with teachers who understand? Are we going to offer these classes in different languages? So
right.
Things like that. So that's how we're going to move the needle. And then family strengthening requires us to see families differently. You know what we love to say in early childhood? Parents are the first and best, most consistent teacher of their children. If we believe that, why are people so up in arms about learning loss over the last year and a half?
You must want to come for another session, because you're talking some things.
Is that amazing?
It
If they were with their best teacher, how did they lose learning? Because they were their best teacher.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. When you mentioned that, it just made me think about, you know, the pandemic again in a different way and equity in a whole nother way, right? Where we have children learning at home, mm-hmm. right? We have companies creating products where children can enhance their learning, you know, mitigate learning loss over, you know, while they're at home. We are even going to give them technology, right? But then we forget that they don't have internet access, right? So like, right? So why can we not think in a whole, right? Like as a whole, in big picture thoughts, when it comes to mitigating equity problems, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. It's always like check a box, like, you know, I'm going to do this, 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 but we're not really ever digging really deep to make sure that that is truly accessible.
Mm-hmm. And Marnetta, we don't talk to the very families we're serving. What do you need?
Yeah.
What do you need? And they may tell you, my child is accessing this on my phone. Because we don't have a computer or a laptop. And then in some situations, some schools are giving one to every child and they already had one, you know, right. Some don't have the high speed internet. So I think talking to the families and finding out what their needs are, but not only their needs, what their strengths are, yeah. you know, a girlfriend of mine during this period, she posted a video of her child and he was learning math. And every time he got a problem right, he'd jump up and dance, and sit back down. And then the next one, he'd jump up and dance. And she says, this is my situation right now. And I thought, how awesome for him to be motivated in that way. Mm-hmm. But what happens when he goes back to school and he gets the problem right and he jumps up and dances?
Sit down. Go to timeout. We're not having that, right?
Yes. And now all that Black boy joy is gone because he's penalized, because he celebrated with being happy, engaged, and learning.
He doesn't get to be his authentic self in the classroom. He has to conform, mm-hmm. right? And learn how to survive in this space.
Absolutely. And when I talked about the way that we viewed parents in the 60s, is it reminiscent of the way we're viewing them right now? Mm-hmm. These children, have they learning loss? Oh, we need more mental health consultants for when they come back. They've been out of control. They've had no rules. That translates into these parents didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
You know, instead of really talking to the families and saying, how did you motivate your child? What excited them about learning? When did they need breaks? My two children, if they didn't eat every 2 hours, it's little bitty things. My daughter is 38 years old. I don't think she's 100 pounds yet, but she eats like crazy and they would get hangry and you'd have a hard time with them. So when does your child need to eat? Do they need snacks more often? What has your schedule been like? Right. When we want to move the needle with family strengthening and equity, we partner with families who are the child's first and best, most consistent teacher to get the best outcomes.
Yeah. And those things that we offer have to think about, you know, what the family, you know, where the family is at, right? So it can't be an 8-to-5. Everybody doesn't work at 8-to-5, right? They don't work a 9-to-5. It might be something that we offer in the evenings, like even including the care, right? So in giving them access to quality care, it's not even just always about the monies. Sometimes it's just about time, right? Like I don't need care during the time that you have care available. How can I still have the support I need, mm-hmm. right? In hours that I need the care.
Absolutely. And I can't tell you how many families, just even in before school care, they have to be at work at 8, which means that child needs to be dropped off at 7:30. You can only drop your child off at 10 minutes to 8. You know,
I ain't going to have a job in a little bit because I'm going to be late every day.
Every single day. Those are the things that we need to take into consideration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we talked about a lot of things and you mentioned earlier, we were talking about like paras and co-teachers and things like that. I want to know what can we do to ensure and support the need for culturally competent early learning educators. What would your recommendations be?
First, it's really going to have to start with training, mm-hmm. with helping people to understand the cultural lens through which they see the world. And that's just across the board. You think about the Brown versus Board of Education decision happened in 1954. And today, in 2021, we're more segregated than we have ever been in this country. Segregated. So you talked, Marnetta, about living in a neighborhood for 20 years that your child can't jog in. So even though you are in this, and I'm going to assume that predominantly white neighborhood.
By a military base.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
Yes, ma'am.
That's a whole different question. Talk. Okay. So we don't know each other. No. We don't know each other at all. And we have this cultural lens that we use that drives everything we do. So in order to be culturally responsive, you have to understand that the lens that drives you is not the lens that everyone has. I'll give you an example. In my family, if an adult calls you, you come. Simple as that. If my mom said, Rose, I come. That's the way it is. And if I'm coming, I say, coming. Now, if an adult called me and I said, what?
Girl.
Oh, my goodness. Talk about trouble, big time trouble.
Yeah.
And I use this because it actually happened to me. I worked in a predominantly Black area when I lived in Los Angeles. When I moved to Colorado, 99% of my children were white. And I'll never forget calling Connor. I said, Connor. And he goes, what? I'm like, what? Surely this little boy didn't say what to me. I said, Connor. He said, what? And I thought, oh, no. And I marched right over there with my hands on my hips, got down to his level and said, did you hear me call you? And he looked at me so puzzled. He goes, well, did you hear me say what?
Right.
He answered. His cultural lens, the expectations for his culture were so different from mine. And it wasn't until I looked in his little face and saw how confused he was that I realized he didn't think there was anything wrong at all with saying what. And I'm unruffled because he said what. Do you see how that cultural lens can end up in cultural disconnects that can contribute to the disparities of Black children being mm-hmm. suspended more often than white children?
Most definitely. And a lot of times we're not honest with ourselves and people aren't going to do a self-reflection, right? Like you checked yourself, right? You're just like, oh my goodness. No, some people are going to be hold firm to what they believe. And it's going to be about, this is what's right. This is what I'm feeling like. This is what it is. And they're not going to take the time to look at another perspective.
Absolutely. Marnetta, what if I dug my heels in?
Right.
He said, yeah, I heard you. Well, why didn't you come? When I call you, you come. And Connor, because that was Connor was... Connor, he would have said, well, why do I have to stop planning to come just because you called me? And it would have turned into something different. So the first step is helping people to understand that cultural lens and having them accept that that lens is also biased.
Most definitely. And digging in doesn't tell, like, it damages the relationship. It doesn't tell the child that you like them or care about them. It's going to impact their learning, right? Because you can't teach me nothing, doctor. Look, Dr. Rosemary, regardless of what your title is, if I don't like you and I don't think you like me, right?
That relationship is mm-hmm. critical, especially for young children. And then you have to help people understand the daily acts of bias that takes place in the early childhood classroom, daily, like mispronouncing people's names. Marnetta, I cannot even imagine how many times your name is mispronounced.
And how many times they ask for a shorter name. And I'm just like, no, it's beautiful. You're going to learn all the letters. Say all of it.
All the letters. Thank you. So not only do we mispronounce, but then we shorten, mm-hmm. we change. I had a colleague change one of our students. Her name is Sashiko. She changed. She said, that's just too hard. I'm going to call you Sasha. She changed the child's name. And because of a power dynamic, you could, if it's a college student, you have power over their grades. Mm-hmm. If it's a parent, you have authority and control over their child. So when the parent says, my daughter's name is Patricia, and you say, oh, I can't say those R's, I'm just going to call her Patricia, that parent will say okay, because they don't want to upset you when you have control over their child all day.
But then they're going to say things behind, like, that relationship's damaged. That's it.
Isn't that the truth? And then people make fun of people's names. You have to understand the history. You have to understand when Africans were brought over to this country, their names were stripped from them. Our last names to this day are our slaveholders' names.
Yes, ma'am.
They're our slaveholders' names. So when these, I just love these young Black girls who are saying, I'm going to name my baby what I want. And we have to accept that. But not only that, when people came over on Ellis Island, they Americanized their names. They changed the spelling of their names. They did a lot to assimilate. And those young people today, do you know they're going to court to reclaim the original spelling and pronunciation of their names?
Oh, beautiful.
Yes, these names are really, really amazing. So that's an act of bias. Another act of bias is being afraid of the neighborhood where you work. Because when you're afraid of the neighborhood, you're afraid of all the support systems that that child and family lean on. Mm-hmm. An act of bias, and we don't think about this because we're not trained to look at it, is when you're in a diverse early childhood classroom, when you allow white children to have dominance and control over children of color, even in play.
Yeah, we talk about that in our banking time training, interactions at the heart of healing and banking time trainings. And you would be surprised the conversations like that happen around that, whether it's, what are you talking about? Why would I point that out? Why is that a problem? Right. Like it's been so interesting.
It's such a problem.
Yeah. Trying to get people to understand.
And when you think about it, white children haven't had the model. Think about it. Think about your schools. For most of a white child's life, they have only seen people of color in positions that serve them.
Ma'am.
They don't see them as teachers.
Yeah.
They don't see them as administrators. They see them as bus drivers, mm-hmm. cafeteria workers, and front office workers. And this is no one's fault. Remember, there's no blaming or shaming, but we have to unveil this. And because they've never had a person of color in a position of authority, then it elevates them as the authority, telling other people what to do and how to serve them. And they learn that early, and they can learn that in our classrooms if we don't stop it.
It's mispronouncing names, deciding you're not going to say that right. All of those behaviors that you mentioned, children are watching and listening and learning as you're modeling without even remembering that you are modeling. Because teaching doesn't happen just when you say, it's on now. All right, Johnny, like, right? It's in all the things that you do once you cross that threshold, once you enter the campus, like children see you, right? And they see your behaviors, how you treat people, what you're doing, and it shifts and changes and builds on their foundation.
Absolutely. Right? And, you know, we teach children how to treat children. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine was telling the story about a child that she had who was a handful. And one day a little girl hit this boy, hit him. And she goes, why did you hit him? We don't hurt our friends here. And the little girl looked at her and said, why do you care? You don't like him either.
Oh, see, that is exactly what I'm talking about. That's a powerful example. And it happens all the time.
All the time. I had a white mother tell me that her child's teacher was teaching her that Black boys were bad. And as I dug deeper into the conversation, because I couldn't believe a teacher would teach that, she said, and it's the way that she speaks about them. Dewan is in trouble. Ahmed is in trouble. And then at first they were in trouble. And then it turns out that 3-4 weeks into the year, they're bad mommy. They're bad mommy. And that's another act of bias when you weaponize children's names. Yes. You know, Dewan, stop. Dewan, don't. Don't make me come over here. It's teaching children who the troublemakers are in our classroom, and they'll treat them accordingly.
Yeah, I could keep on going, but I know they're almost short on time, Darlene. I apologize. I've just, 'cause I could keep on going. you want to wrap it up?
No, thank you. Yeah, no, thank you. I hope you just will keep having these rich conversations like this. And I know that we are also deeply appreciative of this conversation. And Dr. Allen, like you know, there's so much more we can talk about. And like Marnetta and I are like, we could keep going all night with you because we've just touched and just scratched a teeny tiny surface. And as you were talking, I couldn't help but think about that image we all like to like throw up on the PowerPoint or in a presentation of the children in front of the ball field. And I think about how we've been looking at that for a long time, but it seems like we still get confused, equal and equitable, because we keep giving everyone an equal dose, right? Instead of thinking about those barriers and the resources and all those other things that, you know, could keep us going in a whole nother direction. But I think the good news is we've got to start and we have an opportunity to do it differently in a way that we may not have had before. And so we need to keep elevating the conversation to make sure we get it right this time and keep it going, right? So I definitely have a deep appreciation for you coming with us in this conversation in this moment in time and knowing that there's a long way to go. But I think together, if we each do our part and hold each other to it, to be accountable and committed, I think we will see a collective, impact. And there's a long ways to go, but we might just move that needle. Like if we got to just inch it along, even together, I move an inch, Marnetta, you move an inch, and keep it going, everybody. And Dr. Allen, so deeply gratitude, for this conversation, and hopefully it'll keep sparking others to come back to it and do those equity audits.
Yes, you know? Those are going to be so important. I also say, Darlene, I love that you brought up the graphic for the difference between equality and equity. I just want us to consider equity as an action word, that equity is a verb. Equity is what we do because we want the outcome for all children to be justice.
I love that. That's a great, great thing to hold on to. And Marnetta, I'm going to let you wrap us, but oh, what a great thought. Thank you, Dr. Allen.
I think that quote could frame all the things we do moving forward. I love it. Lots of great takeaways. And Dr. Allen, again, thank you so much for being here today. We'll post a transcription and related resource on our site, teachstone.com/impacting. See you next episode when we dig into the current challenges in recruiting, training, and retaining the ECE workforce. And remember, behind great leading and teaching are powerful interactions. Let's build the culture together. Bye, guys.